Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
South Korea's new president wants to bring the country back together after months of protests, impeachment chaos, and huge political rifts.
I don't know, like, what kind of unity he is implementing, but that will be difficult.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. Today, the road ahead for South Korea's Yi Jae-myung. And in Syria, survivors of chemical attacks under the Assad regime can finally tell their story.
So this is where the attack happened?
Yeah.
Plus, new policies are on the way for international student visas in the U.S.
This whole situation this semester made me start doing therapy this week.
Plus, an octopus takeover.
This boom we're seeing is completely unusual.
That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The U.S. has announced plans to scale down its military presence in Syria. This just weeks after the Trump administration promised to lift sanctions. It is a turn of events that would have seemed inconceivable 8 years ago when Syria was unleashing chemical attacks on its own people under the Assad regime, filling territories held by the opposition with noxious gases, wiping out entire apartment blocks full of people, and sparking international condemnation. Now the survivors are speaking out. As The World's Shirin Jafari reports, they're demanding justice and support. And a cautionary note, these are tough memories, including violence against children. So take care while listening.
My producer and I are in a neighborhood called Duma.
She's gonna take us exactly where it happened.
It's a dusty area with rows upon rows of destroyed buildings. It's hot and loud. Motorcycles are everywhere. We've just met 36-year-old Reem Alberi, an engineer who's a survivor of one of the most horrific attacks carried out by the Assad regime.
So this is where the attack happened?
Yeah.
This street, between the square and the bakery, and in the end of the square, it was like the heaviest
strikes.
She takes us to an apartment block in a narrow street. Blocks of concrete have now covered what used to be an opening to a basement. This is where it all happened, she says. It was April 7th, 2018. Families had taken shelter in the basement. A curtain divided the space between men and women. The bombings were so intense, she says. The residents lived most of the time in the basement. Around 7 in the evening, they heard the sound of explosions. But this was no ordinary bombing. A powerful smell filled the air, Derry says, making it very difficult to breathe. Panicked, some of her neighbors ran towards the upper floors, thinking the air is free of chemicals there. But Derry says those were the ones who died. The ones who survived, she says, made their way towards an underground tunnel that led to a medical station nearby. This part of Duma was attacked so frequently that a whole city had formed underground. Only two people in that apartment block survived the chemical attack that night. Derry is one of them. She recalls her best friend and neighbor, Sara, who was 7 months pregnant with her first baby. The city had been under siege for 5 years and food was extremely scarce. During her pregnancy, Sara had a craving for green almonds. Sara's husband would find a handful of them with great difficulty, she says. But each time, Sara would save a few for her best friend. This is how I want to remember my neighbors, Derry tells me. We were so close. Derry says when she saw Sara after the chemical attack, she couldn't recognize her. Her face had swollen. Her clothes had turned color from the exposure to chlorine. As Derry recounts that horrific night, one of her neighbors stops by, Tawfiq Diab, also known as Abu Ali, a middle-aged man with a mournful look in his eyes. Diab invites us inside his home. The guest room is furnished with mother-of-pearl inlaid Syrian furniture. Diab lost his entire family in the chemical attack in 2018. His wife and four children, the youngest, Judy, was 8 years old. His brother, Rateb, was also killed along with his five children. Diab was at his store the night the attack happened. He sells tires. He describes the sound he heard and then points to the ceiling and says, "This is where the helicopter dropped the chemical cylinder. It left a large hole." For months after, Diab says he refused to accept his children were no longer alive. He would go to their school, he says, and wait till all the children had left. Their teacher would come outside and tell him, "They're all gone. Go home." Diab shows me a video of his children on his phone. Qamar, Ali, Muhammad, and Judy playing around. "They should be alive today," he says, tears welling up in his eyes. In 2023, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons found that Assad's forces were responsible for that attack on Douma. Helicopters dropped chlorine gas on homes in the area, but Diab and other survivors say they haven't received any compensation or any kind of justice. Not only that, Diab says the Syrian government forced him to lie about what happened in a mock television interview. Since then, Diab has tried to rebuild his life. He's reconstructed the house, painted the walls, and fixed the broken windows. There's one thing that he's kept as it was, a full-length mirror that one of his sons, Ali, broke. He says he couldn't bring himself to remove it. Survivors of Assad's brutalities have long pushed for justice and accountability. Diab says that true justice will only come on Judgment Day, but he's hopeful that the new government will listen to the survivors' needs. Reem Alderi, who's been listening to our conversation, points out that people here have not received any financial or psychological help. "We need people who specialize in these kinds of traumas," she says. "We don't know if there's a way to heal from what happened, but we need this kind of support." For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari, Douma, Syria.
Of course, Syria today is a country in transition post-Assad. As I mentioned earlier, the U.S. has announced plans to reduce its military presence in the country. That signals improved relations between the U.S. and Syria and changes in the regional security situation. The U.S. currently has 8 small military bases in Syria. The plan calls for just a single base to remain. The U.S. stayed in Syria mainly to keep ISIS at bay. The Islamic militants are still somewhat of a problem. Last week, the group attacked government forces in the south. South Korea appears to have a new president. Results are still being counted, but early poll results show Yoon Jae-myung winning the snap election by a wide margin. Yi is a center-left politician, and he promises to end a chaotic period for South Korea. 6 months ago, the former president, Yoon Suk-yeol, declared martial law and was arrested on insurrection charges. Now, Yi is pledging to heal his fractured country. But The World's Patrick Nguyen says he has got his work cut out for him. Patrick, before we get to who Yi is, can you tell us, the results are still coming in. Is this a done deal, though?
I think it's pretty much a done deal. Everything still needs to be counted, but there's a wide, more than 10% margin in the exit polls, which tend to be very accurate in South Korea, showing that Yoo Jae-myung will be the winner. So I think you can take it to the bank, but of course, nothing's official till it's official.
All right. So tell us about Yoo Jae-myung and the type of president he is expected to be.
Well, he's 61. He grew up really poor, working in a factory and cleaning toilets. He is from the Liberal Democratic Party of Korea, and he prides himself on standing up for the working man and being a fighter. So case in point, when the previous president, Yoon Suk-yeol, imposed martial law in December, thousands of Koreans are pouring towards the National Assembly to confront him, and Yoo was one of them. He's in his 60s, but he's on video just bounding over a fence to get into the action. That's the type of guy he is. Blunt, tells it like it is, and those that can't stand him, of course, they'll say he's abrasive and power-hungry. Mm-hmm. But he's certainly bombastic.
You mentioned the people who can't stand him. South Korea is extremely polarized between left and right. What do people make of Yoo's pledge to bring both of those sides together?
Yeah, that's really the big question in South Korea. I put that to Professor Myung-ji Yang. She's a political sociologist with the University of Hawaii, and she's now in South Korea during the election, and here's what she said about that.
I don't know like what kind of unity or harmony he is implementing eventually, but that will be difficult.
So you can hear some clear skepticism there. To her point, the other top candidate, Kim Moon-soo, from the same right-wing party that backed martial law, you know, he didn't get like wiped out today. He got about 40% of the vote in the exit polls. So many voters saw that party's attempt at martial law, which was supposedly about liberals going pro-North Korea and taking over the country, some pretty intense stuff. They saw all that and said, well, that's fine with me. And as Professor Yang told me, the right wing still has big numbers.
Even if they lose in the election, those 30-40% of citizens will not disappear.
Mm. So big challenges in bringing the country together that Yoo is facing. Another is how to deal with North Korea. Do we know how Yoo plans to handle that?
This is really where the left and right in South Korea diverge. The right is very hawkish on North Korea. This is core to their identity. The left isn't hugs and kisses toward North Korea, but they do want constant dialogue. Yoo, the newly elected president, he wants to reopen a military hotline, and he wants peace talks. He says this is a life or death situation. At the same time, this comes as North Korea is actually getting more withdrawn, which is really saying something. So for decades, both North and South Korea have officially declared that one day, somehow, they want to peacefully reunite. That has changed this year. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un says, let's get real. South Korea is our primary enemy. That is not happening. So the incoming President Yoo will find it pretty hard to get Kim Jong-un to even pick up the phone.
Mm. Finally, Patrick, the U.S. and South Korea are longtime strong allies. How do you see Yoo's victory affecting the country's relationship with the U.S.?
Well, first, in the entire second Trump term, South Korea has been in a huge political mess after its president got thrown out. At one point, the education minister was the acting head of state, just total chaos. So South Korea has not had a stable enough leadership to even get its footing with the new White House. So now we have this incoming president, Yoo Jae-myung. He'll have to make up for lost time. Two big issues. One, is the U.S. president, is Donald Trump going to pull some American forces out of South Korea to save money? He certainly talked about it. Two, tariffs. South Korea sends the U.S. a lot of steel and cars, lots of Kias and Hyundais. Never mind the overall 25% proposed tariffs and how that will hit all the Samsung phones and TVs. So Yoo, even though he's staunchly left on this issue, he's been very careful not to say anything against Trump. He says he favors a calm diplomatic solution. But that's pretty vague, and I think people will be looking for a real policy from him very soon.
Mm. The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carolyn.
Japan's postal service is about a week into a new program that assigns a 7-digit code to individual customers that they can use instead of an address when receiving packages. These codes are intended to correct for mistakes people make when entering shipping addresses while online shopping. People will also keep their code when they move so that they can just update the system with their new physical address instead of updating everyone who mails them stuff. The system is also expected to make things easier on post office workers by by cutting back on all the details to confirm in written addresses. Japan Post says old-fashioned addresses are still required for regular mail, like letters.
Hey there, it's Marco Werman along with Carolyn Beeler, your hosts.
We hope you think that the journalism we do adds something to your life. Maybe it helps you understand the world around you a little bit better or sparks your curiosity about a place you've never been before.
We're able to bring you critical reporting about news and current affairs around the globe because listeners like you support the work of our newsroom. From now until June 30th, we have a goal of raising $25,000, and we're hoping you can help us reach it.
Thanks to a generous donor who has already stepped up to give, your donations will be matched 2-to-1. That means if you give $25, we get $75. A $100 donation means we'll have $300 in the bank to fund our journalism. Whatever amount you can give helps us bring you news from around the globe 5 days a week.
We hope you will seriously consider supporting our work. Visit theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give, or use the link in the episode notes to donate.
Thank you so much from everyone here at The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The octopus population in the waters off of southern England has exploded in recent months. Not many usually live there, but local fishing communities have discovered a bonanza of the lucrative species. In one town, fishers pulled up more than 70,000 pounds of octopus in a single day. That's about 160 times more than they'd caught this time last year. Lisa Beatty is a marine ecologist with Nature Bureau, an environmental consulting company. Lisa, what is happening over there?
Well, if I'm completely honest, we don't know. We know that octopus do occasionally have these boom cycles where they come in huge numbers. The last one was in 2022, but prior to that, we're talking 1950 and even 1899. So we suspect that the warm sea temperatures we've been experiencing might be something to do with why we're seeing these large numbers, but it could be increased prey availability and the short lifespan and rapid reproduction rate of the octopus itself.
So perhaps you hypothesize warmer water temperatures are drawing these octopus farther north than they usually go. Is that how the sea temperatures are playing out, maybe?
Absolutely, yes. The common octopus is on its northern boundary with us, which means that they are a marine biologist's delight. You know, divers go down really hoping and wishing to see octopus, but they're such a rarity that this boom we're seeing is completely unusual. It's not what we would normally expect to find in our waters.
So how did people on shore first realize that there were so many octopuses down at the bottom of the seafloor than usual?
Well, A, the divers were seeing them, but the biggest impact has been on the fishing community. The crab and lobster potters, who would normally set their pots out in strings, they would be baited with escape hatches to allow the undersized crab and lobster to escape. The octopus has been sneaking in, eating all of the crab and lobster that the fishermen would normally haul up and take to market, and escaping out of that escape hatch.
So sneaky.
Indeed. So the fishermen have been lifting their pots and they've just been finding the remains of the three-course meal that the octopus has sat down to.
So fishers first realized that something was going on when their pots were coming up way emptier than usual. But then did they start pulling up a bunch of octopus also?
Yes. And as soon as they realized who the culprit was, they took it to their local conservation authority and they discussed the problem with them. It means that a bylaw has been put in place to allow fishers temporarily to close the escape hatch and catch octopus instead. It means that if they bring up any crab and lobster, they have to put those back because they could be undersized, but they are then allowed to take the octopus to market. And they're currently fetching a higher price for octopus than they are crab.
So this turns out to be quite a good thing for the local fishing industry. Is that right?
Potentially. I think this is more of a stopgap. This is more enabling them to still produce an income from the sea. It's not a long-term solution. There is going to be a meeting at the end of this month where they're going to be reviewing the situation and looking at whether or not they will still allow a catch of octopus, or whether indeed the numbers have naturally subsided. It might be that they stay with us over the summer, and when the colder temperatures return in the winter, that's when we'll see the octopus drop off again.
And so are there just lots of octopus dishes on menus at local restaurants, or are these being shipped elsewhere for consumption?
I suspect, I don't know for certain, but I suspect they are being exported. I'm not seeing them locally. I'm not hearing about them locally. I live in the Southwest myself. And as a rule of thumb, we actually export about 80% of our fish. Most of that has gone to Europe in the past. I don't know where the market is for the octopus at the moment. They could be being shipped up to London restaurants. They're certainly being sold, but I'm not seeing it, you know, on local fish counters.
Interesting. Do you know if there are fewer octopuses now being caught or just present in the warmer waters south where these may have come from?
I don't actually. There is a theory that they are shifting further and further north, but because they have such a rapid reproductive rate, chances are any that we have got in our waters are just reproducing at a much faster rate. So it's not necessarily that, you know, for instance, the northern coast of France and Spain have lost their octopus in order to give us a boom.
So this clearly has disrupted things for people who make their living off of the sea, but does it disrupt the balance of the ecosystem to have those octopus swimming in?
Quite possibly. We are definitely seeing warmer temperatures, warmer seas. We're seeing shifts in different species. So, for instance, we have had more smaller fish like sardines and sprats. Those have been bringing in larger apex predators. I mean, it's fantastic that we do seem to be experiencing a recovery in our bluefin tuna, in our humpback whales, you know, sites that you would ordinarily only associate with the coast of California, you can now see in the southwest of England. You can stand on the clifftops and watch humpback whales breach, which is fantastic for some species, but equally those cold water species that have principally been home in off the UK are potentially being more stressed. So animals such as the ocean quahog, which is a bivalve mussel that can live to 400 years old,
wow,
might be being stressed by the warmer temperatures.
Do you see this as a sign of things to come?
I think it is probably a sign of climate change. We are going to get differing species. We are going to have to adapt. There's no doubt about it. We can't put a stop on climate change. We already know from the experts that we are likely to exceed the 1.5 degrees centigrade in warming. It's now about giving the environment, giving nature the space and the capacity to adapt to climate change. We can't halt it. We need to ensure that we don't accelerate it, but we need to ensure that we are adapting as we go.
Lisa Beatty is a marine ecologist with the environmental consultancy group Nature Bureau. There's at least one other species that's taking over in warm waters, seagrass. We've got that story for you later this hour. The images of yesterday's eruption of Mount Etna in Sicily were eye-popping. Towering plumes of charcoal-colored ash rose miles into the air. This is the 14th episode at Mount Etna since mid-March. What made this eruption unique, though, according to scientists, was not the plume visible from a distance, but the pyroclastic flow that gushed from a crater. That is a mixture of rock fragments, gas, and ash that results from magma meeting snow. The pyroclastic flow traveled more than a mile in a minute, coming to rest in a valley that forms a natural containment area. There were tourists on the mountain who went running when Etna erupted, but there were no evacuations or injuries. The event lasted just a few hours. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Lebanon, the militant group Hezbollah is under pressure to put down its weapons. The group suffered major losses in Israeli airstrikes last month. The Israeli military says those strikes targeted Hezbollah's infrastructure, including weapons and an underground network of tunnels. Hezbollah has said it won't disarm as long as Israel controls parts of southern Lebanon. Sami Halabi has been following all of this. He's with the Alternative Policy Institute, and we caught up with him in Beirut.
Number one, the pressure is coming from the United States. I think that there's a lot of diplomatic pressure coming to bear on the prime minister and the president of the republic, who came into office late last year as a result of American pressure. So that was part of the ceasefire agreement between Hezbollah and Israel. And now we're seeing the fruits of that being the imposition of disarmament on Hezbollah. I think it's something that was clearly outlined in the ceasefire agreement, but at the same time, it doesn't take the political realities in Lebanon into account. And I think what we take away from what's going on right now is that it's just pressure and no process. Any kind of disarmament or demobilization really requires a process, otherwise it backfires.
Mm. So the U.S. is pressuring the Lebanese government to get serious about disarming Hezbollah. How is Hezbollah responding to these calls from the government, or how is it being discussed internally among Hezbollah leaders?
Well, I think the calculus on Hezbollah's side has changed a lot since, you know, the last conflict with Israel. They've also lost their main supply routes through Syria because of the change in the regime there.
Supply routes for arms.
Supply routes for arms, yes, and a lot of diplomatic support as well. It has seriously degraded their capability to rearm themselves and continue their usual, you know, business as usual through their military patron and theological patron in Iran. So we are facing a situation where Hezbollah is in a very different place than it was prior to the war. At the same time, Hezbollah still has a lot of legitimacy in Lebanon, and disarming them without actually providing for a couple of prerequisites, one being that Lebanon actually needs a deterrent to Israeli aggression, because without it, there's no guarantee that Israel wouldn't continue to violate the ceasefire or continue to occupy Lebanese territory or invade Lebanon whenever it feels like it. And that, I think, is a major fear amongst the communities that still support Hezbollah. And we had local elections recently, and there was overwhelming support in those elections for Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon. So I think one needs to put this in perspective, portraying disarmament as a prerequisite rather than an outcome of a political solution is very dangerous.
Right. And Hezbollah's armed forces have been for many years more numerous and better equipped than the Lebanese army. So even if there was a situation where the army wanted to compel Hezbollah to give up arms, it is unlikely that they could actually do that, right?
It's not only unlikely, it's not part of the calculus of either organization, right? At this moment, Hezbollah's arms existed because there was and is an Israeli threat to their communities. The Lebanese army was always and has always been intentionally weak because the United States and any other Western allies don't want to see Lebanon have a very strong army that can face up the threat of Israel. So there is a quagmire here, right? At the end of the day, Lebanon needs to be able to defend itself. It can't defend itself through U.S. supplied weapons through to its army. And the United States is by and large the largest contributor to the Lebanese armed forces.
Because the U.S. has provided as a stipulation of providing arms that they cannot be used against Israel.
Well, first and foremost, and then again, there are other stipulations in U.S. law that that dictate that if, you know, Hezbollah controls or is seen to control any part of the Lebanese army, then all of the support stops. So going forward, it's a very, very dangerous situation, a very sensitive one. And if we bludgeon Hezbollah into submission, they're just going to push back. And if you break Hezbollah, you're going to end up with several different Hezbollahs. Right. And the reason for that is that the core root causes of the problem haven't been resolved yet. So I think there needs to be more of a political position, a political solution than simply a pressure on Hezbollah to disarm.
But there has been progress made toward disarmament, right? Didn't the president tell The Wall Street Journal last week that 80% of Hezbollah's arms have been removed?
That is the case in south of the Litani River, which is the natural border of the south of Lebanon. And there has been a lot of progress in that front. And you know, that is part of the ceasefire deal that Hezbollah is willing to accept. The ceasefire agreement is actually quite clear, is that they should disarm. They are resisting, obviously, because without their arms, they actually have no leverage. And it's not like they have a lot of allies at the moment. So that's where you see an entity that represents a large part of the population feeling like it's under attack. If it pushes back, we're going to fall into civil strife. That's not going to create calm in Lebanon. That's not going to create security for Israel. It's not going to create security for anyone. It's a bit of a chicken and the egg at the end of the day, but I think the solution lies amongst the Lebanese and talking to each other rather than acting, waiting for somebody to solve this for you.
Sami Halabi is the director of policy at the Alternative Policy Institute. He joined us from Beirut. The U.S. has suspended visa interviews for all international students looking to study in the United States. Officials say they're revamping policies and that the vetting will now include a review of applicants' social media accounts. It is the latest move in the Trump administration's increasingly restrictive approach to international students. Michael Fox reports from Quito, Ecuador, on how people there are feeling the impact.
It's a pleasant morning on the square in front of the Student Union of Ecuador Central University. Second-year visual arts student Valentina Aro sits on the grass with her friends.
Creo que es como muy triste la situación porque no es por algo.
The situation is really sad, she says, because it doesn't have anything to do with something that people have done, but it's an individual decision from someone in power in the U.S. She says she knows people who have been hoping to study abroad in the United States, but now that seems nearly impossible. She's also concerned for those who are already there. Beginning in March, U.S. officials began canceling visas for hundreds of international students studying in the U.S., in particular, the visas of those who have been vocal about their political views in the street or online. Secretary of State Marco Rubio defended the measures in late March.
It might be more than 300 at this point. We do it every day. Every time I find one of these lunatics, I take away their visa.
An estimated 4,700 international students have been impacted. U.S. officials say the crackdown on student visas is essential for defending national security. There are roughly 80,000 Latin American students in the United States. Many are concerned.
This whole situation this semester made me start doing therapy this week. I'm feeling so bad and so confused about what to do with my future that I had to seek support.
That's a PhD student from Brazil who's studying at a university on the East Coast.
Also, this has affected a lot my academic performance.
She asked not to be identified for fear of reprisals.
Because I'm the first generation who grew up after the dictatorship was over. But I feel like all that comes back a lot to my mind right now here in the U.S. So I'm afraid of disappearing, ending up in a prison, in a concentration camp.
International students have been detained and threatened with deportation.
You're going to be under arrest. So turn around.
This is cell phone footage of the detention by ICE officials of Columbia University graduate Mahmoud Khalil. His is only the most high-profile case.
You go to school here?
Yes, sir.
In March, third-year University of Florida student Felipe Zapata Velasquez was pulled over, detained, and deported after driving with a suspended license. This is body cam footage of the arrest. He is now back in his home country, Colombia, despite protests from a student group that demanded his release.
The feeling for the few that I engage with is there's a mix of amazed and lost and confused.
Rafael Yordis is a Brazilian professor of Latin American history at the University of Denver.
So it's impacting academic exchange, students exchange between Brazil, between Latin America and the United States.
Professor Ramiro Noriega is the former dean of Ecuador's University of the Arts. He says he has high esteem for higher education in the United States, but what he's seeing now makes him very sad. These decisions are clearly going to impact people, individuals, and communities, he says, because we know that in today's world, the best university programs depend on the relationship between local researchers and researchers from the rest of the world. But the climate of fear has led some students to reconsider their dream of studying in the United States. Marlon Rocha is from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. He was accepted with funding to do his doctoral work at a prestigious U.S. university. He turned it down last month. Probably the Trump administration policies would never affect me, he says. But the idea in your head that you never know what could happen changes the way that you do your research. So I said, no, I can't do it, he says, because it'd be around-the-clock surveillance of who I talk to, what I say, where I am, if I'm in the wrong place at the wrong time, and what's the wrong place at the wrong time. It's a suspension of rights. The United States has long been the top destination for Latin American and Caribbean university students looking to study abroad. Countless Latin American leaders studied in the U.S., including the current presidents of Costa Rica, the Dominican Republic, Ecuador, Haiti, and Jamaica. But these students are increasingly going to look for other options elsewhere. Brazilian PhD candidate Marlon Rocha says he'll probably now stay in Brazil for his postgraduate work. He is likely not the only one. For The World, I'm Michael Fox, Quito, Ecuador.
Updates now on a couple of stories we've been covering. Mongolia's Prime Minister Oyun Erdan has resigned after failing a vote of confidence in parliament. This is the culmination of weeks of protests over lavish spending by his son, which many people saw as a flagrant display of corruption. Before resigning, Oyun Erdan defended his integrity but acknowledged that he hadn't paid enough attention to social issues and internal politics. And management for Chiquita Panama has left Panama. The company will be seeking permission from the government to fire all 1,500 workers who remain, according to new reports from Reuters. This is after firing 5,000 workers after a month-long strike. Chiquita Panama claims the strike cost the company $75 million in lost revenue. Seaweed plays a key role in the world's oceans. It absorbs carbon dioxide while providing food and shelter for ocean life. It also helps maintain water quality. But too much seagrass can throw the ocean's ecosystems out of whack and cause problems on land. And that's what's been happening in the Caribbean. Brian Barnes has written about it in a new report published this week by the University of South Florida's Optical Oceanography Lab. Brian, there is just too much seagrass on Caribbean shores in particular right now. Now, what is the scale of this problem?
Well, it's pretty massive, actually. So the macroalgae that we're talking about is called sargassum. It's similar to kelp. It's a brown macroalgae. You can physically hold it in your hand. And if you've been on a beach, you've probably seen some level of it just sitting there and decaying. And it's a natural habitat. It's been around for a long time, at least back to Christopher Columbus's days. But what we've seen over the last couple of years, and certainly this year, is just huge aggregations of sargassum building up in the Central Atlantic and coming ashore and really wreaking havoc on some of the Caribbean islands.
It's 38 million metric tons is what you have estimated?
That's correct. It's a number that's really hard to wrap your head around. And if you're on a particular beach, even something like 100 tons would be absolutely a devastating amount. And also most of that 38-ish million tons will not impact any beaches. It stays offshore. It's a natural, long-lasting habitat, and it'll just kind of peacefully float along as is its normal course. But when it does come ashore, that's when we start to see these environmental and ecological and economic impacts.
And what does it look like when it comes ashore? I have seen this, and I imagine you have in person. It's pretty smelly.
Yeah, I mean, any given sargassum patch that looks like maybe some blades of grass, there are some little balls look like pea size. That's what keeps it afloat in the water. This thing lives its entire life at the surface of the ocean. So any given patch looks like nothing harmful. But when a large amount of this biomass comes to shore, sometimes it'll pile up onto a beach, or sometimes it'll kind of just be filling an entire embayment, and ships can't get in and out of this because it gets
wow.
caught up in their props. And it really starts to cause these problems because it's so dense.
Can you talk about the smell? And I also understand that breathing in the gases it releases can be harmful to human health.
Yeah, sometimes when you talk about harmful algae, you have a toxin or something that causes, you know, real respiratory issues. This, it's kind of an eggy-like smell.
Sulfurous.
It's hydrogen sulfide, exactly. And it is quite awful to behold, and especially for people that are living in an area, you know, if you're vacationing, you just move to a different beach or something like that. But if you are living in an area that has constant inundations, it really can start to wear down. So we do see increased hospitalization and respiratory distress in areas that have this high and persistent load of sargassum on their coastline.
A lot of the Caribbean islands rely a lot on tourism. Is this causing problems for that industry?
Briefly, yes. But it's not something that is impacting all areas all the time. There are certain areas that are perhaps a little bit more likely to be impacted. Currently, a lot of the sargassum is in kind of the northern area of the Lesser Antilles, and then the southern coast of some of the Greater Antilles, so Puerto Rico and Hispaniola, the island. And then also on the Yucatan coast of Mexico, we've got a fair amount of sargassum just offshore right there. We also have, you know, sporadic impacts throughout really much of the beaches of the Caribbean into the Gulf of Mexico and the kind of the southeast coast of Florida. So that's the Florida Keys, the Miami, all the way up the Gold Coast.
So do scientists know why this is happening, why this is a particularly big year for sargassum?
Yeah, that's a really tough question to answer. And we've got a lot of ongoing research, not just our group, but others in the scientific community are looking at this. And it's really hard to identify a single cause as to why we're seeing so much this year. This is this what we call the Great Atlantic Sargassum Belt, which is the bloom of macroalgae that is impacting all of these areas. It first was observed in 2011, and it's been kind of steadily getting larger over the course of the last 14 years. It's got a seasonality, so it peaks in the June timeframe, and then its low is in the December winter timeframe.
How are communities dealing with this? I've heard of barriers to prevent the sargassum from reaching the beach, even ships out collecting it.
It's really throwing the entire kitchen sink at it because of the consequences it can have if it comes into a particular, particularly sensitive environment. So, yes, you can install barriers offshore that kind of shunt the sargassum away to downstream coastal areas. The other really option is to collect it once it comes ashore and try and collect it rather quickly. And if you are able to get to it quickly, then you can use it to generate some useful products. So this would be pharmaceuticals or cosmetics or biofuels or fertilizers and things. You can repurpose the incoming biomass into something that is in some way useful rather than simply just throwing it into a landfill.
Brian Barnes is an assistant research professor at the University of South Florida. He's been talking with us about the record amounts of seaweed that are washing up on shores in the Caribbean. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Take a drive through the countryside in Japan or whiz through on a bullet train and you'll see terraced rice paddies against a backdrop of mountains. That landscape is iconic, but maintaining the rice paddies takes specialized skills. And if they are not passed down, that picture of Japan could fade into memory. In Fukuoka Prefecture in southern Japan, reporter Hannah Kirshner met a group that's trying to preserve those old practices by teaching one skill in particular.
The town center of Itoshima is full of prefab homes and chain supermarkets. But on the outskirts, there are old wooden houses and terraced rice paddies supported by stone walls. Susumu Kawaguchi, a retired agricultural extension agent, leads a group of over 100 families who grow rice together. Altogether, we have 41 rice paddies, Kawaguchi says. We're standing on a slope below an evergreen forest. The air is hazy with tree pollen. Below us, terraced rice paddies carve out steps down towards a river. We rent them because there's no one to farm them, Kawaguchi says. In recent decades, the children of farmers have chosen office work over agriculture. Everyone in Kawaguchi's group comes from other professions. Not one of us is a farmer, he says. So the group members learn together. Today, we're fixing stone walls, Kawaguchi explains. 80% of Japan is mountains. Over thousands of years, people carved out little flat spaces to farm and build houses. They did that by building stone retaining walls. These dry stone walls are built without mortar or cement, just skillfully stacked stone. These days, a lot of people choose concrete for convenience. But a concrete wall has to be disposed of when it loses integrity after about 50 years. A stone wall can last over a century, and if it breaks, the stones can simply be picked up and reassembled. A few dozen members have gathered, ready with rain gear and work gloves. Kawaguchi introduces Reo Kaneko, a stone walling instructor who has come from Kyoto to help out. Kaneko is passionate about the utility of stone walls. He left an engineering job to do this work. The group listens intently as Kaneko explains the three main rules of building a dry stone retaining wall. Large stones should be placed angled back towards the hillside. Between the large stones and the hillside, you have to fill in with small stones and gravel. This helps rain and groundwater drain downward instead of putting pressure on the retaining wall. Each large stone must rest on at least two others. Friction and gravity keep them in place. As the group gets to work, Kaneko coaches them. These days, most people think a stone wall is something fancy, like around a castle. In fact, dry stone walls can be cheap, quick, and easy to build. The basics can be learned in a weekend, Kaneko says.
The most important for farmers and usual people is less energy, less cost.
Now we think of machinery as efficient. But in the past, efficiency meant working with the natural features of the landscape instead of fighting them. The terraced paddies here are irregular shapes and sizes, conforming to the contours of the mountainside. Kaneko points to the winding road climbing towards the top of the rice terraces. He explains that if you just want to make the best road for a car, you make a straight line.
If you want to use less energy, so you have to read the geography and make natural line.
For Kaneko, dry stone walling is more than a practical technique.
Because it's a kind of symbol of people have good relationship with nature.
To build a dry stone wall, you don't have to manufacture or destroy anything. You just move rocks around. The older stone walls here in Itoshima are covered in moss, with wildflowers growing in the cracks. They've become a habitat for insects and reptiles. Frogs breed in the rice paddies, and hawks come to hunt them. These terraced rice paddies were built for people, but have become a rich ecosystem. And it's all held up by dry stone walls. For The World, I'm Hannah Kirshner, Fukuoka, Japan.
Creative control is a necessity for some artists. Case in point, a musician who goes by Shima. She was born Tina Johnson and grew up in Tokyo. Her mom's Japanese and her dad is American. When she was 14, she caught the attention of a Japanese entertainment company. The company was looking for a talented, bilingual student interested in joining a new girl group, and before she knew it, she was part of a J-pop group, Fakey. But Johnson was still in school and had to find time for singing and dancing lessons, music videos, concerts, and recording sessions. Meanwhile, she had no say in her career. After a few years, she wanted out and headed to the University of Miami to study music engineering so she could make music the way she wanted to. That is when Tina Johnson became Shima. In this song, 1807, Shima samples an ancient Japanese folk tune. Fukushima has a busy summer planned, gigs at festivals, new music ready to be released, this time all on her terms. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. Two ways you can connect with us online. Our Instagram has photos and videos that take you further into our stories. We're at The World, easy enough to remember. Or subscribe to the podcast so you never miss a show. I should have said and, you can do both. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for listening.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Betsy Atwater in memory of Paul Atwater Connolly, Helen and Russell Pine, the Sarlo Family Foundation, and the Patchwork Collective. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.